Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR. Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The polls in Virginia's governor's race have closed as the Commonwealth awaits the results of one of the most consequential political contests in years. Democrat journeyman Terry McAuliffe and Trump-endorsed Republican Glenn Youngkin are running neck and neck. But there is so much more at stake in a state that could very well turn red tonight. We have a lot to pick apart in this race. And joining me right now is Dr. Niambi Carter, political science professor here at Howard University. And you, the listener, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to hear from you tonight, your opinions. If you are in Virginia, if you are a Virginia voter, whether you voted early, whether you voted today, I want to hear what you have to say. Again, lines open, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Certainly, we invite you to tweet me at H. Fisher, W-H-U-R, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Carter, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation.
Sure.
Absolutely. Busy day for you today.
It's definitely been busy, but I'm sure busier for all of those who are waiting for the result, you know, for Virginia residents.
Yes, indeed. Certainly pins and needles. Things began to shift a great deal a couple of weeks ago when you talk about the polls. McAuliffe was leading for most of the race. Then things began to tighten up. And indeed, some of the polls that were coming out last night and today had Youngkin 1 point ahead. What do you believe is the critical issue, or perhaps there are critical issues for this race?
Oh, for sure.
What do you think?
I think there are a number of things that are happening. I think, you know, education, of course, has been a moving target where you had Republicans really beating the drum of this critical race theory, really Youngkin whipping up white voters, quite frankly, who may be, you know, liberal enough to vote for Joe Biden, but they draw the line at talking about race. And let's be clear, no one is being taught critical race theory in schools, but that's part of that conversation. And not too far from that, of course, is the coronavirus and a lot of questions around vaccine mandates and mask mandates. And McAuliffe has said he favors mandates. And Youngkin has said people should have a choice. So I think the coronavirus is there. Then the economy. I mean, the economy has sort of rebounded to the top of that list as well for Virginia today. So I think there are a number of things at play in this race. I don't think a single issue sums it all up.
On the topic of the critical race theory point, is it possible that just the discussion about race or history regarding a race-related history is the thing that many people are mistaking for critical race theory, where it is beginning to supplant what people of a certain age may have learned about their own history? And I should say people of a certain age, people of a certain color, people of a certain culture.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, I think white people have a lot of difficulty navigating conversations about race where, you know, it makes them uncomfortable. And I think, unfortunately, we're in a place where white people's discomfort means that the rest of us can't sort of tell the truth of our experiences. Critical race theory became sort of a catch-all term that some Republicans and others sort of glommed as the big bad wolf here. And we know that critical race theory really isn't taught in a lot of places. It's a legal theory that really sort of is talked about in, I think, more theoretical circles, maybe in some academic circles, but it's not widely taught in the ways that many would have you believe. And it certainly isn't about casting some people as evil and some people as good and all of that other stuff that people have been saying in these school board meetings, which are just not true. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is the case that it is not being taught to primary and secondary schoolers. Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, people say it enough, then people start to believe it. And we know that we're in a sort of post-fact nation where you can just say things enough, and if you say it with enough authority, then it becomes the truth. And that's kind of where we are right now. And you have a lot of white people who have real difficulty talking about race. And this is irrespective of ideology or partisan leaning. And so anything that makes them feel bad, right, and I'm using that in the most general sense, is therefore off limits or triggering or not okay for children, et cetera, et cetera.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Virginia elections, not just the governor's race, but the lieutenant governor's race, the attorney general's race, and indeed there are dozens and dozens of state delegate seats also up for grabs. Joining us right now, Melanie Campbell, the president and CEO of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. Melanie, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you. Good to hear your voice.
Absolutely. Good to hear yours, too. Who do you think is the most critical voter in this political contest right now?
In
Virginia, who is the most?
Oh, in Virginia?
Yes. Who do you believe is the most critical voter right now?
Oh,
who,
black, who? The black vote. Yeah, black vote. Black women.
Why? Really?
And the data proves that. Right?
Do tell.
Who got that vote out? You know, it's definitely a turnout election in Virginia. You know, I vote in Virginia. I will say this morning early, I was out there before 7, and it was, you know, more people had shown up than I had expected. So it's going to be a nail biter for sure.
So,
but when you look at the last governor's race, Terry McAuliffe ran 8 years ago. He thanked black women, right? Yeah.
But in this particular race, there are, as Dr. Carter and I were just discussing, there are, you know, undercurrents, there are racial, you know, dog whistles, but there are also issues about the economy, issues related to health and COVID. And as you and I have discussed, for years, black people and even black women are not monolithic in their politics.
Oh, no. Look, the reality is that you're going to have either a black woman lieutenant governor or black and Latina lieutenant governor tonight. So that's one story that really hadn't been lifted up in this race. Right.
Yeah, and which is what I was about to ask you about specifically. You're talking about the Democrat Haya Ayala, who is Afro Latina, and Winsome Sears, the Republican, who is a black woman, a military veteran, Second Amendment a supporter. I mean, we've seen her very, very outspoken about Second Amendment rights. Can talk to me a little bit, if you can, Dr. Carter, about how these two women compare and contrast.
Well, I mean, I think to Melanie's point, black voters are going to be critical in a place like Virginia. I mean, they're part of why Virginia turned blue, right? I mean, you have black folks all through the Tide border, rich area, in other parts of the
Dr. Carter, I think
where
we may have had some problems with your audio.
I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
No, go right ahead. You're back. Go right ahead.
Around Emporia, Essex, and other places. But I think this is the two things. So Winsome Sears is a Republican. She's an immigrant. You know, she was educated in Virginia. And I think when you look at her and Ayala, I think some of their biographies look the same, but I think they represent very different things. And I think when we're talking about women of color, I think people always say, well, people are just going to go for the person that looks the most like them. But that's not always true. And when you're talking about black voters, it's not just about what you look like and how you present. It's also the things that you stand for. And I think Winsome Sears may not be able to convince black people, even conservative black people, that this is the way that they want to go in a place like Virginia when you have critical issues on the ballot, like abortion, which matters a whole lot to black women, and reproductive justice. When you have things like voting rights and civil rights on the docket, right? So Winsome Sears may not be able to pull it out. I mean, I think it will be historic, whether it's Ayala or Sears, but it is certainly the case that I think it will be the harder sell for the black Republican than it would be for the Afro-Latina Democrat, quite frankly.
Do you agree with that, Melanie?
Yes. I mean, Virginia it has had a lot of migration into it, and so it's very much not the Virginia of 20 years ago, right? So the diversity here, a lot of young people have moved to this area, including, you know, metro area, and so when that's why, you know, people are, of course you can't just win with Northern Virginia, but it does matter, right? And if you have a large turnout, that's good for the Democrats. If they have a marginal turnout, that's not good for them, right? Just the numbers would wash out. But I think part of what has been challenging in this particular election that the Democrats have to really be concerned about is just the perception that the Democratic Party itself doesn't have its act together. It's going to be interesting. I haven't seen any polling yet about whether or not the fact that the Democrats haven't been able to pass any meaningful legislation, pass federal voting rights, pass these funding bills, how that will really play out. I feel, based on the people I talk to, that anecdotally, that there is a level of frustration that was there. But like I said this morning, the turnout was higher than I expected to see it, even over here where I live.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Virginia election 2021. Polls closed at 7 o'clock. Some of the votes are coming in. I want you to also understand that the way the process goes is that the early voting that was done last week, those votes are counted first. Early voting and absentee votes, those votes are counted first. And then, of course, after that, the votes that the live in-person votes also counted today. And so we are getting some results right now, just really a small percentage right now. And we are seeing that McAuliffe is trailing Youngkin, also Ayala trailing Sears, Herring, the Democrat, trailing Meares as well. Mark Herring, the Democrat running for Attorney General, and Jason Meares looking to unseat him. So again, these are just some of the preliminary results coming in. We're talking less than 10% of the vote coming in right now. So we certainly have a long way to go, but certainly want to keep you up to date on the way that things are, you know, are coming in. I do want to, you know, kind of get to the point of some of the broader issues, because, you know, anecdotally speaking, we do understand that, you know, a lot of your, you know, Ma and, you know, Ma and Pa, Kettle Joe and Jane Sixpack, they care about what's happening in their communities and may not necessarily see this as a referendum on the larger national issues. But the reality is that the specter of former President Trump hangs in the balance. Certainly, the we have seen Terry McAuliffe speak publicly and privately about the lack of political strength that President Biden seems to have. Your thoughts about that, Dr. Carter?
Well, look, I think, you know, Melanie is exactly right. Many people have been saying this for weeks. The Democrats need to win, right, nationally. They need to prove that Joe Biden's platform is actually viable. And the fact that it looks like, you know, you have control of the Senate, you have control of the House, you have control of the presidency, and you can't get anything done, then what is going on with the party? And I think a lot of people view the Democratic Party, at least at the national level, as just not having the courage and the backbone to really do what Republicans do, which is whatever they want, and then they make up the story afterwards, right? And this has particularly happened around voting rights, which I think for a lot of Black voters in other minoritized communities has been extremely important, because we see bill after bill after bill introduced in multiple state legislatures to restrict voting rights. Yet it seems like Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, and many others in the Democratic leadership are really reticent to take it to the Republicans about the filibuster, or at least do what they can do procedurally to make something like voting rights filibuster-proof. And at the same time, you have, you know, Democrats like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, who seem to be able to sort of just tell the party what to do and seem to be far out of step, not just with what Democrat constituents want, but with their own constituents in their home states of Arizona and West Virginia, respectively. So I think the national does reflect on the local. Of course, the national is not everything, right? But it is certainly the case that both Youngkin and McAuliffe have been calling in some really national heavy hitters, right, to make the case about why they're the right person. Youngkin, of course, allowing Trump to sort of endorse him from a distance, right, and McAuliffe trying to tie him to it. But, you know, but with also McAuliffe bringing in Biden and Obama, right, to do this work. So they're both trying to nationalize a state race, but for different ends, and I think it's hard to get away from it, but I don't know that it's going to sell Virginians. And of course, it's a very delicate balance that you have to dance, because at the end of the day, you still have to be responsive to your constituents, and those are Virginians, not people in Maryland, not people in North Carolina or any other part of the country, but Virginians. But it certainly has become, I think, a bellwether election.
Yes, indeed. I need to take a break, but I want to thank Melanie Campbell for sharing in the conversation. Always good to have you. I'm glad to hear that you got out to vote, but of course, not a surprise. Why? I mean, really? That's what you do. So, thank you so much.
You're talking to everybody else, and then I'm not sure. But thank you. I wish I could hang a little longer, but I appreciate it.
But that's all right. You have work to do, as always. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Lay from D.C. We're going to talk to you next, so please do not hang up. You will hear the program. And for everyone else, give us a call. Want to hear from you as well. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. In just a bit, John Wands is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. We'll be back on Sirius XM and 96.3 HD2, the app. Don't forget to download it on your smartphone. Stay with us. We'll be talking more in just a bit. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking about Virginia votes. That's right, election 2021. Lots of big decisions being made today at the voting booth, including governor, attorney general, lieutenant governor, and much, much more. My guests tonight are Dr. Niambi Carter, political science professor at Howard University. Also, we have attorney and Democratic strategist A. Scott Bolden. And you, the listener, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lee, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
I work in Old Town in Virginia. I live in D.C., but I work in Old Town. So for about the last month or so, I've been driving into work, and I'm in the neighborhood. I'm seeing all the Yunkin signs and stuff like that, and that's so I was starting to get nervous. Frankly, and maybe one of you guys the guests can explain it to me. For about the last 3 or so months, I actually was thinking that McAuliffe ran a horrible campaign. I didn't understand why it seemed to me you had commercial after commercial after commercial after commercial from Yunkin, and there was really almost like nothing from McAuliffe. It seemed to me like really only the last, month and a half, all of a sudden you're starting to see his commercials, and it was a bit annoying because it felt to me like, oh, okay, here you guys go, the Democrats at the last, you come out at the last minute, the last 30 days or 45 days, and all of a sudden you're rushing, and then now you want the black folks to come out, but you haven't been doing anything. It just seemed to me like he kind of sat there and wasn't out there matching Yunkin in terms of commercials and getting his message out, and it just seemed like a half step too late or not as full-throated, and I don't know. I just felt like he ran a horrible campaign. You guys have more experience. Maybe you can tell me what I'm seeing wrong.
Well, let's see what A. Scott Bolden has to say about that. Scott, thank you so much for joining the conversation. First of all, what do you think about what Lee is saying to us?
Well, I didn't hear all of what Lee said about the signs when she was driving in. I can tell you what was annoying was all of the ads from Yunkin and McAuliffe. I tend to disagree, but again, I live in D.C., and so I what the market share was in D.C. versus Virginia. But I can tell you there were a lot of those ads. I do think that the McAuliffe campaign was slow to respond to the education issue in the debate and explaining away what he meant by parents shouldn't have anything to do with their kids in education. That was a problem. They took it out of context. He was talking about the Beloved Act that he had rejected because he said that the regulators as well as the board, State Board of Education, certainly could do that job without the parents opting out of what their kids could read. But this race is going to be all about education and whether Yunkin has found an issue that the majority of parents find so significant that they will vote for him despite his ties to Trump as opposed to McAuliffe. We'll have to see. It's a very close race. Millions of dollars have been spent, and now it's up to the voters. And now that the polls have closed or are closing, we're going to just have to start the count. She's right about one thing. This should not be a close race at all. McAuliffe should have been running perception-wise as an incumbent, and Yunkin found an issue, and you couple that with Fox News, and you see the gains in regard to the independents and the western part of the state. The bottom line is, did the Democratic base come out today for Terry McAuliffe and Biden and the Democrats, or did they not? That's going to be the difference maker.
Your thoughts about Lee's question, Dr. Carter?
Well, it's hard to say, right, because we are only in one part of the state, right, or near one part of the state. So I, like Scott, have seen a lot of advertisements for McAuliffe and Yunkin. That said, we don't know what he did downstate. And quite frankly, when you think about the lay of Virginia, right, where you have places that are growing and you have, say, large swaths of the black population, they're not necessarily in this part of the state. And he was going to have to pull those people back out like they did a year ago, you know, really a year ago today, and try to bring in sort of moderates, white moderates in Northern Virginia. But in a place like Loudoun County, right, which has been sort of firmly Democratic, I mean, it's dicey because you have those same sort of people who either think of themselves as independents or who consider themselves sort of moderate Republicans who may have cast a ballot for Biden in 2020 because they couldn't stomach Trump, but may not feel that same desire, particularly around this issue of education and sort of race being infused in that education or how you talk about race. So I think, you know, it's hard to say what the sort of full range of that campaign has been, because we don't have a full postmortem yet. But I do have to agree with Scott, at least, that McAuliffe really came into this as if he was a newbie to this game, instead of as a person who'd previously been the governor. But I wouldn't count him out yet. I mean, he scrapped out a win the first time. I'm not saying doing it by 3 points is desirable, but it's possible. And we may see that again here, but who knows?
Okay.
Yeah, but you know what, man? I also think that Youngkin campaigned differently in the red part of the state, in those western jurisdictions, compared to how he campaigned in Northern Virginia and suburban Virginia, vis-a-vis when he was trying to hold on or gain independence by saying, I'm a softer, more likable, khaki-wearing Trump. I'm the more human side of Trump. But make no doubt about it, he's Trump. He accepted that endorsement without a doubt. He's injected this culture war in education. He certainly has embraced the big lie in those red parts of the states. And so he is Trump. He may look better. He may sound younger. He may wear vests. He may wear khakis. But make no doubt about it, he's a Trump. And that ought to be motivating for Democrats to come out and vote, regardless of what they think about Biden or regardless of what they think about Terry McAuliffe. We know Terry McAuliffe. We know what he's done for the Democratic Party and for people of color in this country, and voter access, and bringing millions of jobs and investments to Virginia in those 4 years. And he's promised to do the same. The question is, can he pull it out, given this this younger, nicer version of Trump in certain part of the cities that Youngkin's been selling, including parents being committed to education?
Yeah. Lee, thank you so much for your phone call and your input. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Amy, calling from Silver Spring. Thanks for calling, Amy. What's on your mind?
Basically, a lot, just piggybacking off what everything said, Dr. Carter, education is the main thing. I know in Virginia, a lot of the schools, being from Silver Spring, that I drove past by, you go to the urban places and you see that they're teaching, yes, U.S. history and so forth. And then you go to the rural areas where a lot of the people that did vote today for the Republican Party are all against the critical race theory. And a lot of it has to come with the fact that we are living in a country now where all these votings are based off just race. I mean, we do know that there are people somewhere in Virginia or West Virginia that are still, you know, despite of their color or race, that they're still not, you know, capable of surviving. We're spending over $35 million on campaign ads for something that we're probably not going to remember in the next 50 years. However, it is critical that we look forward, even the Democratic Party, that we come to an understanding that the future generation, the future leaders of this United States of America are going to need that education, that the real education, not the just the regular, hey, you know, white lie, this is what happened, this, really what's going on in Virginia, per se, or Maryland, or D.C. Everything needs to be taught. What happened in slavery? What happened? All of that, especially in the state of Virginia.
Okay. All right. Well, Amy, thank you so much. I think she does makes a couple of really critical points, you know, Dr. Carter, in that it isn't all about these top tier issues. I think one of the things that we have heard so much about, at least from the McAuliffe camp, is getting resources to some of the more distant parts of Virginia. And when you're talking about getting, high-speed internet and some of the other resources, and those things are tied to, to these infrastructure things that are still stalled on Capitol Hill. And that is one of the things that you have not necessarily heard from the Youngkin camp.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Youngkin wants to stay away from certain conversations like abortion, for example, because he knows it's going to perhaps drive away white women who were really important, right, for the Republican campaign in 2016 and remain a very important part of that base, quite frankly. But it's true that these infrastructure things that you talk about are largely forgotten kind of in this area, because people forget that Virginia is a big state and a lot of Virginia is rural. A lot of Virginia is not city. And when you get very south, Emporia and some of those small little places, Dinwiddie, right, access to things like internet, access to things like healthcare are really critical. And yet, I feel like McAuliffe didn't do enough in helping people connect the dots to some of those bread and butter issues. And as Amy said, you know, when you talk about a state like Virginia, which has such a mythology around race, right, romanticizing this sort of Pocahontas narrative and the coming together, whites and natives, and, you know, even sort of their intermarriage laws were okay if you were a descendant of Pocahontas and John Rawls. I mean, it was just sort of insanity, the sort of racial narrative that Virginia likes to tell itself, right? Right. And you still find Virginia sort of telling itself that it's sort of becoming liberal and it's expanding and it's growing. And it is in certain places like Richmond and Hampton Roads. But when you look at a place like Loudoun County, which is firmly Democratic, you don't see the black population in that county expanding in the ways that you do other parts of the state. So why is that? Maybe Virginia is not as liberal, right, as it likes to think of itself. And when you start talking about other people's experiences with this nation and how other people experience that state, it makes people very discomforted. And nobody wants to really, and not say nobody, white people in particular, want to confront that particular history and that particular brutality, because then you can't say, well, I didn't know and I'm not responsible. It's like, now you know, so what do we do to go forward? And that's the conversation I think people want to leave off the table. And Youngkin is giving them a space to say, it's okay. Right. Don't feel badly. We just don't have to acknowledge or talk about it.
Yeah. Scott, before we let you go, final word from you.
Yeah. Let's be real clear. The critical race theory is not taught in Virginia schools. It's a political gimmick or phrase to start the culture war on education. And so your listeners should really understand that this issue of the beloved legislation doesn't get anywhere near critical race theory, but it is a kissing cousin of it, the way Youngkin has couched it to his voters and to the voters in Virginia. Secondly, what he's really trying to do, you know, white women are super important, but white educated women and men who are independent and in suburban Virginia are key to his winning. If he's to pull those from Terry McAuliffe, then he's going to win this race. I was just looking at some of the early returns. He's up 56-44 over Terry McAuliffe. It's very early in the race, but at the same time, you can see even early he's running strong. But you see, it's a fool's paradise. It's a fool's pot of gold if those voters from either Democrats or Independents that follow and drank the Youngkin Kool-Aid, because it's the Trump Kool-Aid. And so I think this country, let me just end with this. I think this country is an incredible country. It's a beautiful country, but it is an imperfect country. And if you love this country, then you have to learn about the good, bad, and the ugly. And slavery and racial oppression have been an important part of America's legacy and part of the promise that it has never come through on in regard to black, brown, and people of color. And so everyone should appreciate that, learn that, value that, grow from that, and love this country because of that. Yeah. Right? There are no perfect countries, nor is America perfect. So I hope everyone deeply appreciates that. Those are my best thoughts, and I appreciate you having me. I got to hop now.
All right. A. Scott Bolden, thank you so much. We appreciate your input. Joining us now, Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter. Latasha, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. I want to start with you about some issues outside of Virginia, because even though some would argue that Virginia could very well be the bellwether, the most important political contest right now, there are some other issues that are going on related to the vote today. We can... let me just, you know, shake the dice up and just kind of throw it to you. Let's talk about what's probably geographically closest, New Jersey. We've got a governor's race there. Talk to me about that.
You know, it is a, we are in a critical moment in this country. You know, I we're hearing kind of this attack around this whole notion of attack on critical race theory, which is actually a ridiculous premise of what people are raising. And we know that. We know that there's organizing around voter suppression all across this country. And then now we see these two big races, there are two governor's races happening right now in both Virginia and New Jersey. And both of those races are going to be key, particularly in terms of determining what is, you know, what policies are going forward if you're going to have at least have a shot of a progressive candidate or a candidate that is actually a part of what I call the big lie, you know. And New Jersey is like one of those kind of critical states because they're also dealing with a lot of the issues that we're talking about now around trying to marginalize the vote. And it looks like that's a seat that a Democrat has held and that the GOP wants to get that seat. They're actually actively going after, the Republicans are actively going after
Governor Phil Murphy.
Phil Murphy.
Yeah, the incumbent and the, you know, trying to be unseated by a Jack Chiattarelli.
The challenge is, you know, what we see is he has been the first incumbent. Phil Murphy has been reelected since 1977. And so part of the challenge and that what they're framing it, and they're also framing it as if Chiattarelli is a moderate Republican, but we all know that some of the forces that are behind this, because New Jersey is traditionally a very blue, a very Democrat state, right? And so some of the forces that are behind this is, I think that this is beyond Virginia and New Jersey. Like, there are issues at both of the states that we're dealing with on the state level, in both New Jersey and in Virginia. But this is a testing mechanism. I think that based on what happened in the 2020 election, based on what we saw from the voter suppression, based on what we saw on the misinformation campaigns, what we know is that literally, you know, I think it's a test to see, does voter suppression work? Will voters get so turned off in the process that they'll stay home? Oh my goodness. Hello?
Yeah, we're still listening. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yeah. I can hear you. We're going to get your sound straightened out. Dr. Carter, the next issue that, you know, I do want to move to is the Atlanta mayor's race. You've got Felicia Moore, Kasim Reed running. Why in what we always used to call the land of milk and honey for black folks, you know, why is this race so critical?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of the Kasim Reed being there, I think, is sort of what we saw with Keisha Lance Bottoms when she was running. Is Atlanta going to stay a black run city? Right. And I think that's always one that matters to a lot of sort of so-called chocolate cities around the country, because some of the folks who would have been the base of those elected officials have been sort of gentrified out of those cities. And then you have sort of these incoming white populations with a very different set of expectations for their political leadership. And this is aside from the sort of ethics and other kinds of discussions around corruption, official corruption, from that particular administration, but there's these larger sort of issues around where do black voters matter and do black elected officials have a responsibility to making sure those black communities stay black, right? Those black cities stay black, and creating a space for black leadership in the mayor's office, but also in city councils. And I think we saw with this last sort of election in Atlanta, that almost slipped away. And I think people are looking at Atlanta like, so are other cities like Washington, D.C. going to be shortly behind, right? where you have, you know, even in a place like Philadelphia, white mayors again, right? Is this going to be a different moment for black leadership and black elected officials in these cities that have been reliably led by black mayors? So I think that's why, at least for me, Atlanta is an important race to pay attention to.
Drop in with a little bit of breaking news. This not unexpected. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director for the CDC, has signed off on the approval for children's coronavirus vaccines for children ages 5 to 11. We could very well see vaccines, one-third doses for Pfizer vaccines for children starting as soon as tomorrow. So that just coming down, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, signing off on the CDC panel's recommendation for COVID vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. Certainly that is the beginning and not the end of the discussion as it relates to COVID vaccines for the youngest in our population. Certainly the Biden administration already had been gearing up for this for the past 2 weeks or so, saying that there are vaccines available for some 28 million children. So we will continue to follow that issue as well. I do want to get back to our discussion at hand. And I think probably, again, outside of Virginia, one of the other big issues is the police reform vote in Minneapolis. All of this coming after the murder of George Floyd and the sentencing of Derek Chauvin this year. Your thoughts about, you know, this issue of police reform, it's on the ballot. I really do believe, Dr. Carter, that this really would be a watershed moment and something that the entire country is watching, not just politicians, but police organizations and citizenry.
Absolutely. And I think other localities are looking to see what happens, because so much of policing happens on the local level. Want to see how this turns out, because if it turns out that people support this and it doesn't lead to absolute chaos, like I think many detractors have been suggesting, then this may be a model moving forward. And I think, you know, when we see at the national level, Democrats and Republicans can't even have a conversation about this, right? I mean, you see Tim Scott and others sort of just trying to come to some understanding about the same things, and they can't even get to it. So I think people are looking at the local level as perhaps the place where we really need to incubate and experiment with these things, because what people are saying is we want safer communities, and we don't know that people carrying guns are the way to get us there. And certainly if we had wraparound services and other kinds of responses, that we may be able to de-escalate and also create a situation where people actually seek the help that they need. If we don't sort of criminalize mental illness, or we don't criminalize drug abuse or other kinds of things, then maybe we can get our hands around the sort of human root of many of these same issues. And I don't think, you know, people, you know, kind of hand-wringing about like, oh, it's going to be total chaos in the street a la The Purge, is right here. What people are really saying is that we have given all of these resources almost with no oversight or proof that they work, without any real expectation that police officers be accountable, and it still hasn't necessarily made us safer. So I do think all eyes will be on this city, because people recognize that this could have rollover effects or roll-off effects, in other localities where people are struggling with the same questions and trying to figure out a way to manage sort of the protection elements of this, but also the service elements of this. And creating a space where we can actually see that happen, I think, will be really an important kind of moment, as you said, a watershed moment, because I don't think we're going to see this nationally, particularly because qualified immunity is such a touchy part of that negotiation.
But I would argue that the rhetoric, and you mentioned Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, and I think that he too has been an advocate, but also a victim of the rhetoric, the defund police, and I really don't think, other than those who are just so, whether they're radical on the left saying to get rid of police, or radical on the right who say that is what the left is trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I really don't think that anyone is trying to get rid of police. And even in the case of this situation in Minneapolis, okay, they want to replace the city's police department with a public safety agency, but even changing the charter doesn't mean getting rid of police.
No, but I think that's the problem, right? This is the sloganeering, and on both sides, right, where people are really imprecise at what they mean. And I think what people are talking about is, let's reallocate our priorities and make our budgets reflect our priorities, right? And moving away from this language of policing, right, as opposed to public safety, might even change how people think about what it is they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to see us, right, law enforcement officers, as people they serve, as people in need of protection, not enemies. Right. And so maybe if we can change people's orientation to the position and reorganize how we allocate those monies and maybe even their priorities. Right. I mean, we see it in Philadelphia. We're not going to do minor traffic stops anymore.
Right.
That's a place where a lot of people have their first run-ins with police, and they're generally not pleasant. Then let's change that, and let's provide more funding for the agencies that actually do the things that we want them to do, like deal with people who are having mental health crises, like dealing with people who are unhoused, who may be living in spaces in the public where people don't want to see them or where it's not safe for them. Let's have deploy those people who can put people in connection with the resources that they can need to find shelter, as opposed to locking them up for loitering or locking them up for, you know, violating some public ordinance about sleeping in a park, which might get them killed, right? We've seen that happen, right, in Milwaukee and other places. So I think what people are saying is, what we're trying to do with police reform is reallocate our priorities.
Yes.
And that does not mean getting rid of all police and putting, you know, thousands of people out of work and that kind of thing. I don't think that's what people mean. And I think, you know, unfortunately, you know, defund the police is precise, but it also makes people weary. And Republicans are really masterful, or I will just say police advocates are very masterful at using that language against those who are really saying, let's try to do more of what will make the most of us feel safe.
I think you put it beautifully when you're talking about whether it is loitering, you know, true loitering, whether you're talking about, traffic stops or people in the park or looking at policing more holistically. The only other difficult argument that can be made is that even as policing changes, criminals may not. And I think that's the other side, you know, of the coin, which is why, as is the case in this Minneapolis issue, that they're not talking about fully getting rid of police. As a matter of fact, their charter does not allow that. The city charter does not allow police to be dispensed with. So no matter how the vote goes, the police there are going to be around. But hopefully this will be a new way to look at public safety. We will have to keep an eye on it. Mm-hmm. Dr. Niambi Carter, always, always a pleasure to have you on the program. And and all of our guests that have been with us. We really appreciate you. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Harold.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, November 2nd. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.